7 minutes after 9 o'clock. Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the CBS McKaiser Show. I hope that you are well wherever you might be this morning. Plenty that has happened in the news cycle for you and I to create meaning around, to try and understand the lawfare continues in this country. A massive constitutional court judgment yesterday handed down that now requires, in her personal capacity, that the current public protector must pay some money in relation to the Bancor matter and the majority judgment, not unanimous. That's something I'm going to come to later and what that means, deciding that indeed that she needs to pay because they didn't take too kindly the history of this particular case. So that's an important issue for you and I to puzzle through. A little bit later, after 10 o'clock in the middle hour, we go back to the deep south, to areas like Lanesia, parts of El Dorado Park, Ennerdale, and we will have representatives from those communities here with me in studio, and we talk about the class warfare that I think really is a tragedy, while the state continues to not really perform optimally across the length and breadth of our country, and poor people are at loggerheads about informal settlements versus those who live in brick houses, and that is really not a good thing because we're tearing ourselves apart while the state continues to be useless. And then in the third hour, I've got Sabelo Sekete, who does amazing investigative journalism, in studio with me. We're going to be bringing you up to speed in case for the last couple of weeks you've been missing out on what has been going down at the PIC inquiry. So that's what we've got in store for you. It's 9 minutes after nine. 702 Open Line. But I start the show right now by speaking to Rudy Klabi, who is a journalist and an author. News broke late yesterday afternoon. I'm not a reporter, so I don't brag about breaking news, but many of you I see this morning had retweeted a lawyer's letter that had landed in my possession, which is a letter signed by and written by Rudy Klabi's lawyer to the Commission of Inquiry chair, that she, in fact, is now applying to give evidence and to cross-examine former President Jacob Zuma. I had reached out to author and journalist Rudy Klabi. She's exceptionally busy, but she does have 3 or 4 minutes for the Eusebius McKaiser Show to just talk to what went into this particular decision. It's not a decision I would imagine anyone would take lightly, even though it's not a court of law. Even a quasi-judicial process can be very intimidating, and certainly at the very least will absorb a lot of one's time commitments, money commitments, and your mental space. Rudy Klabi joins me on the line right now. Rudy Klabi, good morning to you, and thank you so much for coming on the Eusebius McKaiser Show.
Hello, Dave. Nice to be with you.
Really, when you first caught wind of the fact that your name had been mentioned by the former president at the state capture inquiry, where were you, or how did it come to your attention, and what was your reaction?
That's a very important question, because I was minding my own business, picking up my daughter from school, and I was with my little daughter, so the two of them love to play in the garden at school before we go home. So I was literally rolling on the grass, holding little children's hands as they get onto the slides and the swings and all of that. When I returned to my car, my telephone, I had so many missed calls from media, from friends, from family, and then some WhatsApps as well. And then I saw people tweeting and WhatsApping, "You've just been mentioned at the commission." And I didn't know what it was about. It took me a good 2 hours to find out what had actually been said, because I was so busy being a mom. And you see this? This was my reaction. Laughter, 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 because I thought it was ridiculous. In fact, every member of my family thought it was ridiculous. That was my reaction.
And then upon reflection, of course, the laughter would have given way to more serious thought, I would imagine, because if a commission into state capture is a very serious commission. In a sense, this goes to the heart of some of the most fundamental looting that has happened in our country. But now you have former President Jacob Zuma, who in a broad opening statement talks about a grand conspiracy of individuals that have been plotting since the late 90s to try and topple him. And then I would have imagined at that point, your laughter must have then segued into a more serious reflection on how it is that your name could have been inscribed into that conspiracy.
And that's exactly how the emotional and the mental and intellectual evolutions happened. Upon reflections, I realized that these cannot be dismissed as delusions of grandeur of a former head of state. Why, you see this? Precisely because, number one, he is a head of state, so what comes out of his mouth is significant. Secondly, people are busy on social media saying, but why are you bothering? I bother precisely because if the commission is to restore its dignity, then it's very important that the content and the matters that it deals with are of a serious nature. So a former head of state thought I was so important that I ought to be located within the deliberations at the commission. So I didn't elevate myself to that status. Secondly, Eusebius, if somebody can tell a brazen lie under oath, then it is appropriate to question what else is he lying about. That is the second thing. The third thing, Eusebius, if the scene of this commission is state capture, then by his testimony, Mr. Zuma is raising serious questions about how he accesses information, how he makes decisions, and also what other decisions were made in the name of the Republic using the same type of modus operandi and the same unreliable information. So it's very important that we go there. But on the fourth level, and this one is a personal level, since I left 702, I've been very busy on the international space as a speaker, as a moderator. I have plans to write more books. And if a former head of state actually says, I see another news report says Zuma accused me of defaming him. It's bigger than defamation. It's not defamation. He accused me of getting information from foreign sources and dark forces in order to bring him down. That is a very serious allegation. So at a personal level, there is a part of me that really wants to challenge this precisely because it's got implications on me as a professional, as somebody who goes to the United Nations, who speaks to presidents, who speaks to newsmakers, authors, filmmakers. I speak to everybody. If the last word on my profession and how I do my work is that I work with foreign forces to bring down presidents, then we actually have to test that and see who's the last man standing.
Third, last quick question, really. Have you, in fact, planned inadvertently or coincidentally any kind of movie about the president, about rape in general, or based on your best-selling book on the subject matter of Fezeka?
No. But there's a but, Eusebius. You've written books before. It is par for the course for filmmakers to approach authors. My first book, let me talk about that one, Endings and Beginnings, a book for which I'm most proud. I was approached by various filmmakers. And then, ultimately, I sold the film rights to a local filmmaker. Has there been a film? No. You know why? Because you don't just sell film rights and then there's a film tomorrow. What needs to happen is that people need to raise a lot of money in order to bring a film to fruition. So Endings and Beginnings was published in 2012. Film rights sold in 2013. 6 years later, there's been no film. Let's come to the story of Fezeka Kuzwayo. Do you know, Eusebius, I've been approached by at least 8 or 9 filmmakers. And let me tell you how they would approach. I'd be sitting at Tasha's having my cappuccino, and someone says, hey, lady, I read your book. I'm an aspiring filmmaker. Can I do your film? Hey, lady, it's been happening all over. Have I signed on the dotted line, raised money, and produced the film? No. And the joke is, none of the people who've approached me are based in the United States. So I'm curious to know where Mr. Zuma gets his information.
Second last question. Mr. Zuma is not an idiot. He may be rattled in terms of where his political career is at. Are you at all worried that he has any kind of aces up his sleeve, if indeed the commission then allows you to go and give your version from a process point of view, or even to cross-examine him? Or are you so certain that he had told a bald lie that the only person who can lose in a cross-examination is the former president?
Okay, let me answer it this way. You started by saying Mr. Zuma is no fool. Neither am I. Mr. Zuma is courageous. I'm also courageous. Mr. Zuma is sure of his story. So am I. Now, you see this. The second one, does he have an ace up his sleeve? I don't know. He probably does have an ace up his sleeve. But if he does have an ace up his sleeve, it has nothing to do with the allegations that he made against him. Because when you are certain, of your own truth, there are no moments of doubt. And I can tell you without any fear of contradiction that there is no doubt. I'm just as ignorant and curious about this film as the next person.
Last question, and my apologies for taking up more time than I had assured you that I would. We live in an era where there's a lot of digital trolling that happens. We have seen how many women journalists in particular have often experienced death threats, rape threats, when the subjects about whom they write have fans behind them, bots behind them that uncritically have a love affair with those gigantic men and women, and invariably it's men. I'm just curious, have you experienced that at all? Because you now open yourself up also to the legions and legions of supporters of former President Jacob Zuma. Have people dispassionately watched in the last 24 hours this announcement of the application that your lawyers are making on your behalf? Or have you yesterday or before already experienced any kind of interesting response, backlashes or otherwise that have caused you any kind of consternation?
Yes, Eusebius, and here I have something in common with Mr. Zuma, and I have great empathy for him. He mentioned on the second day of his testimony that his secretary was called and death threats were made. So I have screenshots of people who actually threatened me and my children. Really kind of a 30% type of mentality, because how do you threaten someone online? I'm coming for them too, by the way. Anyway, I was threatened with death. People said I deserved a tire and petrol, and my husband and kids were called all sorts of names. Somebody said I must watch my children. Somebody said I deserve a firing squad. I've got all those names, by the way. And Twitter must do its thing, but I also do my thing. The point here, Eusebius, is that as people ask why bother, it's precisely because of this that I bother. Because in the name of Mr. Zuma, he didn't instruct those people to threaten me, but in support of him and what he has said, they felt bold enough to issue such threats. So do I just roll over and die? Well, I think that keeping quiet about it and going about it quietly actually escalates the threat. But if I put it out there in the public, let's deal with it then. So yes, you see, I have had those kind of threats, and I don't think that any newsmaker must get away with making reckless comments and inadvertently, not even inadvertently, as a result, then endanger somebody's life. It has happened before, Eusebius. It has happened before. I often dismiss it and I move on. But precisely because the catalyst was commentary from a former head of state, I've got all those messages that were threatening to me. And that's one of the reasons I am approaching the Zondo Commission.
Ready, Tlhabi.
But also there's no guarantee that I'll be granted permission, by the way, to give evidence and to cross-examine. I need to address this. You see, that's very
quickly. Okay, yeah. How does that work here, process-wise?
A lot of these Einsteins on Twitter saying, well, so-and-so was denied permission to cross-examine. Why must you be given permission? There are rules of the commission, and I'm not responsible for so-and-so. I'm an individual. You apply to give evidence and to cross-examine. Mr. Zondo and his team must use their discretion, and I'll respect whatever they decide. There's no guarantee I'll be given permission. But as for those people who weren't granted permission, then you need to ask them. The rules of the commission, you can't just come and cross-examine someone. You need to give evidence under oath, and I'm brave, courageous enough to do that because I'm quite sure of my story. Thank you very much.
And that's award-winning journalist and author Reedy Tlhabi. Reedy Tlhabi, thank you so much for making time for us. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, it is an open line. Let me know what you want to talk about. 011-883-0702. 011-883-0702. That is the number here in the studio. And in Cape Town, 021-446-0567, including your reactions there to what author and journalist Reedy Tlhabi had exclusively said on this show right now. And I think that it is sensible. This is not about some journalist, something wanting to have a moment in the sun. I've seen large numbers of you supporting Reedy Tlhabi, one or two of you saying, don't bother going there. But it was really interesting listening to her very systematically explaining in detail how much thought she had given to the decision that she's taken. And she's right. You have a journalist here who's on the international circuit as a speaker, as an MC, as a facilitator. And there's nothing worse than a potential client doing a Google search and there's some word cloud of controversy related to your name. And remember, whatever you think of Jacob Zuma, even if you think he's a joke, the truth of the matter is that the title former president of an entire country, especially a middle country like South Africa, that is still quite important geopolitically, what a former president has to say about an individual is not a small matter. So this isn't just about defamation. It can also have an impact in terms of, in future, her ability to be able to literally and figuratively travel quite easily as a journalist from one event to another. So there is that. And then there's the matter of just the truth biographically about who you are, what you have done. I mean, to be accused of being part of some grand conspiracy against the former number one citizen of your country is also no small matter. So if I was in her shoes, I think I would also have taken some legal advice, given it some serious thought. Don't know if I would have ended up applying. And as she says, there's discretion. She can still be declined. Don't know if I would have ended up applying, but I would have given it exactly the same level of waiting that she had done in her thinking through about what is at stake here. And after all, if the former president is so sure of his version, then presumably he should invite cross-examination in relation to everyone that he has mentioned, not just Rudi Klabe, even the people that he had called spies and what have you. And this is the problem. This is the problem. It's one thing to say all of these things broadly, although there are even limits there in terms of defamation law, outside of a court of law or outside of a commission of inquiry. But when you say certain things specifically under oath, it gives it that extra status in terms of truthfulness, guided by the value of oath-taking that happens before you speak inside the Commission of Inquiry as former President Jacob Zuma. So her reserving and, in fact, now asserting her rights, I think, is perfectly, perfectly legit. 26 minutes after 9. 702. Open line. And then there's something else that I wanted to comment on, which is how minority judgments work. Yesterday, the public protector obviously got a huge thumping from the Constitutional Court. It wasn't a unanimous judgment. Now, some of you, despite the fact that we do bring you expert lawyers, good legal journalists on the show consistently, you are so hell-bent, whether you are for or against Jacob Zuma, for or against Pravin Gordhan, for or against Advocate Mgwebane, for or against Cyril Ramaphosa, to not listen to the experts, to not read documents and simply make assertions based on your feelings, that you repeat things that are just factually incorrect. And I'm going to challenge you. And I'm not ashamed to say when I'm wrong. I mean, if I say something that's wrong, I'll concede it. Or if my argument is weak, even if it's based on some true facts, I will concede it, because there's no reason to feel emasculated when you have an opportunity to learn from someone who knows more about yourself or who simply is more convincing in how they thought through an important issue. But here's where many people have gone wrong in how they read the minority judgment yesterday. I don't give a damn what Chief Justice Mogoeng Mogoeng had said in the minority judgment. It is not settled law. So if you've never read law judgments, and yesterday for the first time you discovered, as a fan of Advocate Mgwebane, that there's such a thing as a minority judgment, well, let me set you straight, because I actually did study law for 3 years. A minority judgment is A, not a new thing. It happens the world over. It happens in our courts of law every single day. Is it a good thing that it happens? Yes, it is. Because what it means is that judges, magistrates, justices of constitutional courts, judges of the Supreme Court in America are not robots who all think the same way. They have different hermeneutics, or in simple English, they interpret laws differently depending on their convictions. That's why they have to be persuaded by lawyers who argue in front of them. So sometimes they will disagree. A court can be split 3-2, 4-3, 7-2, 10-1 for that matter. You can have a whole bunch of arrangements. It's also the reason why it's useful to appoint to a particular matter an odd number of judicial officers, if you can, so that if there is disagreement, that the numbers are clear. And if you have an even number, different courts around the world have different rules. Some jurisdiction, if you have an even number, then the status quo remains, for example. So the rules differ from place to place. But the bottom line is this. A, it's a good thing that judges from time to time disagree with each other. Unanimous judgment is not routine. And there's nothing weird about minority judgment, because judges, as human beings, as intellectuals with their own personal, intellectual, political, and jurisprudential convictions, will see matters differently. Reasonable lawyers can reasonably disagree on a whole bunch of issues. But there's no practical consequence that flows from the minority judgment. It is simply academic. It will be archived, and that's it. Scholars of the law will be able to use that stuff and say, this is what the majority judgment had said. I know the majority judgment won, but here's my paper in the Proceedings of Law of 1953, why I think that the minority was right, even though the majority's position is the one that is now the court's position. That happens all the time. But the practical effect, in other words, the part that society must now comply with is what the majority said, not the minority. That is how it works everywhere. So finding me one paragraph of Mogoeng Mogoeng disagreeing with his colleagues just shows me that you discovered law yesterday. Sometimes the minority view becomes the law of the land if it is a lower court and there's another court to which you can appeal. But here's more news for those of you who pretend to not know this. The Concord is the final court. It is the apex court. If you can think of a pyramid structure, it is right at the top. The only small Nyana complication, which is not important for purposes of the point I'm making, is that on non-constitutional matters, Bloemfontein is still important in how our courts are structured. But for all intents and purposes, the Concord in Bloemfontein is as good as it gets. After that, you've got to lobby Parliament to change either through legislation, the structure of the court, or the laws themselves. But what the majority of the Concord said, that is settled law and that must be complied with. And the analogy that I used on Facebook is this. And if you don't get this analogy, there's nothing more I can say to you. Then you've got to call a friend and see whether they can do better than you CBS on the radio. It's a little bit like going to idols. You sing. You hope to get a golden ticket to go to Theatre Week. Randall says, it's a no from me, Abel. DJ Fresh says, it's a no from me. Unati says, it's a no from me. And then Somizi says, Una, Fumna, it's a yes, Baba. A yes. I think you're amazing. And then you go outside, and then when Proverbs says to you, and then, where's the golden ticket? No, they were being unfair. There's no golden ticket. But Somizi said, I must get one. So where's my golden ticket? His minority view is important. No. The fact that a minority of judges said you must go to Theatre Week doesn't mean you're going to Theatre Week. It is interesting for history to reflect in the records that Somizi wanted you to go to Theatre Week, but he lost it. One judge, one vote. 3 out of 4 decide what the view of idols is. The fact that a minority likes you is neither here nor there. You are not going to Theatre Week. 28 minutes before 10, here's the latest in EWN headlines. 25 minutes before 10 o'clock, 011-883-0702. Prince, good morning.
Good morning, Sigurd. How are you?
I've never been better. The world is a good place and worth fighting for. How are you, darling?
Even if I was there, I was probably going to give you a big hug. I mean, the way you explain this. God. No, seriously. As we're going on, I'm just thinking, you know, you couldn't have made it any clearer. You know, let me add on to that. Remember during that Constitutional Court judgment where Parliament was then instructed to set up a disciplinary proceedings for precedent or disciplinary something? Mokwen Mokwen dissented in that judgment as well. He was very, I think he was against that whole principle of separation of powers, whereby it felt as though the judiciary was then encroaching on.
Yes.
So he dissented in that judgment even. So, guys, this is not even the first time he's dissenting in a judgment where he's lost. So all
absolutely, Prince. And before you continue, spot on, by the way, my apologies for interrupting. Equally, he has been part of, and we mustn't make it about him, it's about the principle of dissent and how it works. But equally, he's often been part of some very good majority judgments where other people have dissented.
Exactly. Exactly. So the fact now that he's dissenting, guys, we just on Twitter, I saw yesterday, everybody was posting the dissenting judgment. Oh, by the way, remember that issue. The shift. Justice is not the Concord. I mean,
absolutely.
So that's the reason why when you put it that way, I was so. And again, you see, there's one last point that I want to make. You see, I think the court would not, in the first instance, prefer to give you a personal cost order. I mean, you have to be exceptionally bad. You have to be.
Absolutely.
So the court was at pain. to hand down a personal court order. So when guys, let's not think as though the court was for you to be punished. I mean, you see, there's words like making false submission under oath, acted in bad faith by us, does not understand the functions of the office. I mean, how bad can it get you, CBS? I mean, this is bad. This is bad. So for the court to say, to describe you with those words, and then to punish you, the court is not enjoying it. But you have just pushed them. You are that bad that they have to say, you know what, so I don't think it's a good precedent, personally. But again, what do you do when you are faced with somebody like Nkwebane who lies to the court under oath? That in itself, it's a criminal. I mean, so yeah. Anyway, yeah.
You put it, most important sentence that you said, there were many important sentences. You don't need Eusebius. But for me, one of the most important you said was, the Chief Justice is not the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court is based on one judge, one vote. That is how it takes decisions after a long process of legal deliberation, debates that they have, research that they do. The institutional position of the court is one that flows out of the majority judgment. Minority judgments are academic. The only time minority judgments are more than academic is when they come from the lower court, because the next level court in the structure of the court system may determine that a majority in the court below were wrong. But after the Constitutional Court, there's no one that you can appeal to. Your best hope is that some sneaky little case that looks suspiciously like the one that happened yesterday appears again in future between in this court, and that a new Constitutional Court bench finds some very crafty way to effectively overturn its own case law without being seen to be done so. So that can happen, but it happens rarely in all apex courts. But the reason an apex court is called an apex court is there's nothing after Braamfontein.
Just 2 seconds, from my final 2 seconds. You see, let me also put it out there. The fact that there is a dissenting judgment is healthy for our democracy. Like
yes,
you pointed out,
absolutely.
If we had a majority judgment and all the judges said yes, it's not a good thing. I mean, I think the fact that we have somebody says I think differently, it's a good thing, guys. So let's not. Thank you very much. I
mean,
the wrong
position. No, I mean, we have a mutual appreciation society going on here. Not only is what you're saying right, you know what? As a political analyst, and just as, forget being a political analyst, just as a person with a brain, you should be suspicious of a society where judges make unanimous decisions all the time.
Exactly.
Because it means that those decisions are engineered. Given that lawyers, like readers of a fiction novel, necessarily will find different things likable and unlikable, it would be very weird to have perfect unanimity all of the time. And any society where that happens in your judiciary, there's probably something weird going on in that system.
Yes, exactly. So it's healthy for our democracy for us to have dissenting judgment. And the fact that it's the Chief Justice, it shows that, yes, You are the Chief Justice, but every day, Uksala, you're not the Crown Court, you know. So, thank you very much for putting this out there. And I hope EFF supporters, can you guys just get it for once? Please.
Absolutely. Thanks, Prince. Botumelo, good morning.
Hi, Yusibius, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you very much. How are you?
Very well. Just a quick one. If the commission were to deny ready to cross-question Jacob, under what circumstances would they do that? Again, if they do allow her to cross-question him, can that be as quick as possible so that he remembers, he doesn't forget?
I love that. I thought you were going to say as quickly as possible so that you can take time off from work, go and get Ama Kip Kip and go and sit at home to watch the proceedings. The short answer, Boitumela, is I haven't the foggiest. If there is a lawyer or just an average Joe that have carefully read the terms in terms of, not the terms, the specific rules for the commission, please help us out. I actually do not know legally how that decision is made. The important point that Rita Tlhabi made is that she's not entitled to the request being accepted. And that seems to me to make sense practically. Otherwise, if there was a right to cross-examine instantly, then obviously this commission could sit until the second coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, if she exists. So that can't be the case. There has to be discretion. How the discretion is exercised, I actually really do not know. If someone else does know, as a matter of legal fact, I'm not talking conjecture. If you actually do know, set us straight, because I'd also love to know. 011-883-0702.
702. Open line.
Kafisha, good morning.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you this morning?
You know, I think I've just been in the state of anxiety because if you've been on Twitter, which I assume you have been, you've been seeing all of the sort of misinformation or disinformation that sort of exists on this platform. And, you know, I was looking after the judgment yesterday. I think one of your other callers also said that everybody just kept posting the dissenting views. And now I've seen posts about apparently Thuli Madonsela had so many of her reports taken on review and so on. And, you know, I just kept wondering about how do we engage with this type of disinformation? Because I know sometimes we take the view of, well, you know, trolls will always be trolls. But I genuinely think that some people just don't actually understand, without sounding patronizing, but don't understand what, you know, the nature of the law sometimes. So somebody I've seen was quoting Chapter 11 of the Constitution to say that, oh, the Chapter 9 public protective powers have always been binding, you know. And there's other posts that I've seen about the same thing about apparently Tully's remedial action taken on review. And my whole thing is that how can you make this judgment? You know, we need to see, okay, how many reports did Thuli Madonsela release? How many of this have been, you know, taken on review, if there were any? And how many of that did the court say that she acted negligently or, you know, behaved in bad faith? And then only we can make these judgments. But I'm just thinking about how do we not engage with trolls, or is the onus on us to try and put actual facts and information out there?
You know, you've shifted the conversation a little bit. You know, it's so interesting. My relationship with social media keeps changing. I don't know what yours is on a personal level. I went from being highly engaged every second of the day about 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, I was 30 and I had the energy. Now at 40, I'm a little bit wiser. Some people obviously never get wiser with age, like Helen Ziller. They still behave like a 12-year-old on Twitter. But honestly, life is too short. You've got to ask yourself, what are the projects that are most important to define your place in the world? And are you being on Twitter 24/7 and engaging even the trolls 24/7? Are you living your purpose? Is your mental health okay? Or are you simply detracting from the things that really should truly define your limited time in this place before you kick the bucket? And frankly, Kafisha, just talking for myself, I log off after 12. If there's a major news-breaking item, like the Rita Tlhabi story late in the afternoon, I'll quickly go on. And even then, I can't tell you how many people are retweeting, because honestly, I'm at a point in my career where retweets don't define my success, and I don't even care how many people are agreeing or disagreeing with it. I just factually tweeted something that landed in my lap, and then I'll come back, and during my show, I engage people like you, my listeners, who don't always listen to the show through sound, but by the chronicles of the content on Twitter. Over weekends, I completely get rid of the app on my phone. I haven't missed major news. I am healthier. I wake up on a Saturday morning. I do other things. And so I think one has got to be prudent about how you engage social media. It is an enormous opportunity to democratize dialogue in the world, but it is also simultaneously, like most things, double-edged. The other side of the coin is that it's also a source of incredible anti-intellectualism, online bullying, and even a threat to mental health.
Definitely. But, I mean, I 110% agree with you, but I also think it could potentially be a dangerous space if we don't see how disinformation on social media has started to break democracies across the world. And if you have to look at a young population who are sometimes actually only consuming their news via Twitter and via Facebook, you know, I mean, we've seen this with like Brexit and Trump and Bolsonaro in Brazil and Veer and Modi in India, about how these disinformation campaigns were used to sort of swing votes. So for me, this, yes, I understand for mental health purposes, it's not worth it to sort of argue on Twitter. But I also feel that, you know, social media has been weaponized. And those of us that are sort of working in a space of social justice and so on are starting to see that we are not 10 steps ahead of the game. You know, we thought that social media would be used for freedom of expression, you know, for more people to gain access of opinion. But there seems to be, you know, there's this dark side of the game that's being used against us. And we need to get ahead of this. So there's this interesting documentary, I think, that's come out tomorrow on Netflix called The Great Hack. And it's basically about what happened in Britain over the whole Brexit crisis.
Let's do this, Kafisha, because you've piqued my curiosity. I mean, obviously, not just as someone who's in media, but for all sorts of reasons, just as someone who consumes media. I think maybe we should try and do a wonderful, productive conversation around how best we can harness social media for social justice and other purposes while trying to minimize some of the pitfalls that come with it. I don't think you can be a journalist, for example, without being on social media. If someone applies to be, I don't know, editor at a company that I run or my executive producer and they don't have a Twitter account, a Facebook account, they won't get the job. On the other hand, I also would never advise anyone to be slavishly present on social media because they will never be productive. And so the question is, what does it mean to do both, to be present without being unproductive and guarding your health and still harnessing it for social justice goods? And I think that's a wonderful question that we can frame. And let's do an entire sort of social media workshop on radio, as it were. I'm going to think about it. I'll think about who the best people are and just watch the space. Thanks for that recommendation.
Good, thanks.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Before we do so, I want to read something from journalist, if I can find it very quickly, from journalist Vukani, that I think is also really important on this thing about minority judgments. Now, here's the other thing, okay? Here's the other thing about minority judgment. Listen carefully, the entire country. Vukani Mundere says, you know, Eusebius, the funniest thing about the minority judgment, it's not exactly kind on the public protector. At one point, the minority judgment itself argues that her Reserve Bank mandate remedial action was patently ultra-virus, so obviously and ridiculously unconstitutional that we should all have laughed it off instead of getting angry. They really argue their dissent on a more narrow ground that effectively, says Vukani, that we need to treat her almost like some sort of special needs child. Don't be offended by little Boosie's cursing and bad behavior. She doesn't know any better, and ultimately it's all harmless. And that's the point. Even some of you who are quoting one sentence, I don't think you even read the minority judgment. You make it seem as if Mogoeng Mogoeng is a fan of Mokgweebane. She is not. Read the minority judgment. Still coming up in the next hour, we're going to be looking at what's been going on in terms of some of the news that we have been seeing when it comes to the area around Lanasia, Zechariah Park, parts of Aldo's, Ennerdale. You have seen communities there at loggerheads with each other. And we've got representatives of those communities will join me here in studio. And I'll explain to you why we wanted the communities themselves to be here. The state is not in today's conversation, even though the state is an important actor. And I will explain to you in the middle hour what our thinking was. But we thought as a first step, what is most important is to get the communities themselves to speak for themselves in their own voices about their experiences, their needs, so that you can hear from them what it is that is the history behind the images that you might see when you turn on the telly when you come back from work without any context in terms of how did you get to the point to where you see all these horrific images of stones being thrown, knobkerries being wielded about, And then very often we casually anthropologize the poor and working class communities in this country by imagining that they're a bunch of entitled marauding hordes who are simply bloodthirsty without any kind of biography in terms of where they fit into the South African social and political landscape. And that is false. And we're not even getting the real anthropologist in here or even social justice lawyers necessarily. In the first instance, communities shouldn't be spoken at, but should be rendered visible so that they can speak for themselves. So that's kind of our thinking behind how we're treating that topic. That's still coming up in the middle hour of the show. Sean, good morning. Thank you so much for holding on, Sean.
Yes, hello, good morning, Mr. B. Look, here is my view. I think that Advocate Nkwebane is a factionalist who unfortunately lacks the sophistication and the smoothness of a known or identifiable factionalist. And I think perhaps to those who continue to criticize us, I think it must be said that sometimes, if we argue, all of us, that we must protect the office, then sometimes we need to punish the incumbent in order to continue to protect the reputation of the office. And I think this is what has happened here. And I think it's very clear to me. We don't want to end up saying, let lawyers speak to legal issues. But it's very clear to me that to change this country, one might need to then convert to technical speak. And we teach ourselves that, a lie, there's a caller earlier who spoke very well. There's criminality here. To lie under oath, the last time I checked, and I don't think you need to be anyone who knows anything about the law, but to lie under oath is a crime. It is contempt. And I think we haven't spoken enough about the fact that this lady has committed a crime. So apart from the issues of ethics, issues of sympathizing with her, the Zuma idiocy, there is a crime that has been committed by someone who holds a very, very, very important office. And I think if you also study the minority judgment, yes, there is an issue around Mukwang, speaking about the issue of cost. But here is the issue. It's very important that he says what he says, because he, as the Chief Justice, he must at all times be concerned about the separation of powers. And where he feels that, look, with rather guide here, then he needs to say that so that it's not seen as the judiciary encroaching into the other levers of the state. So it's important that he said what he said. But the issue is that you've got someone who has lied, and we can't be a state that that just degrades and goes to levels of a better liar and a worse liar. She lied, and I think she needs to be treated like the way that we treat any other person that we think has lied under oath.
Absolutely. Well put, Sean. Tanti, I hope you are listening. I'm not sure whether you are only tweeting but not listening, because you might be responding to my own tweet from yesterday. But if you are listening to the open line, I'm going to answer you on the air. I'm sure you'll tell me on WhatsApp whether you are listening. Tanti Pai, economist and good friend of mine, says a minority judgment can be important as a conversation with the public and legislators could be opened up. An example is in... And then Clanty tries to show off with an example from America. But here's the point, Clanty. Of course that is true, but I mean, that's not news, dude. But there's a couple of things here that you need to take into account, right? And then we'll leave it there for today. We can come back to it at 11:30 or on the open line tomorrow. Firstly, actually, the most important conversation that should happen between the public and the court and the legislators in the court is actually with a majority judgment. Like, can we actually start there? Because that is the most important thing. Before we talk about how interesting it might be to listen to a good minority judgment, when the majority says Batabile Dlamini is a delinquent, the first conversation to open up is, citizens, are you going to vote for a party that will put this woman potentially back in the executive? So before we even romanticize the beauty of a cogent minority judgment, can we get the basic rights? And in a basic functioning democracy, we actually need to learn to respect the majority judgment. Unless and until majority judgments are routinely the basis of a conversation between the courts and the public, or the courts and the legislature, it is actually a luxury to worry about the minority judgment. It really is, because that is next level stuff. There are levels to this thing. Level one, respect and start a conversation about the majority judgment. That alone is not yet entrenched in society, Clunty. So to talk to me about the beauty of a dissenting judgment when majority judgments don't necessarily get complied with immediately is problematic, because the rule of law demands as step one that the majority judgment be the basis of the public conversation. Let's take yesterday as an example. How much conversation was open up to today across the length and breadth of the country about the majority of judgment? Little to none. So to talk about Mogoeng's dissent is to get your priorities wrong. Your priority should be open up a conversation about the majority. But your point is theoretically correct, and I'll give you a South African example because your American example is one that most of us can't identify with. Simple example, Justice Kate O'Regan in the same-sex marriage case dissented with the majority, and she was a dissent of one. And that's actually how my journalism career started, as a student writing a letter to the Business Day way back and supporting what Kate O'Regan had said. And you know what she has said, Clunty? In a dissenting minority judgment, and that's an example of what we should do, as you rightly say. She said, "I agree with my colleagues that gay people should be allowed to get married. I disagree with the majority that says we should take 12 months before we allow gay couples to get married. Gay couples should be allowed to get married from the rising of this court. As soon as this court setting is over, gay couples should be allowed to get married right now. There's no reason to wait 12 months and to ask the legislature to come up with new laws, because we can simply read gender-neutral language into the existing rules right now." So minority judgments can be important, but in a country where the rule of law is not entrenched, it is the majority judgments that we should first become excited by.